John Fain.
On radio, online and on digital.
Conversation Hour on 774 ABC Melbourne
and on ABC Victoria.
Shortly we'll be joined by our first guest, Reg Livermore, star of Hair and Jesus Christ Superstar, Rocky Horror Show, Betty Blockbuster Follies. Reg has done so much and he's going to be starring in Wicked when it comes to the stage somewhere near you soon. So, Reg Livermore joining us shortly, together with Kate Dundas, who's a landscape architect who thinks we waste a lot of space. Now, Reg Livermore's great passion has been gardens, so they will get on like a house on fire, I'm sure. My co-host for the journey, from the ABC's disability website Ramp Up, Stella Young, good morning to you.
Good morning, John.
Are you going into the comedy festival, it says on my screen?
I am. I actually, it was my birthday on Monday, so I took the day off.
Happy birthday.
Thank you. I took the day off to work on my festival show. I had to do, just those little admin bits that you neglect when you're actually writing the content of a show. So, you know, I had to make a Facebook event and book an Auslan interpreter and do all those kind of things for it. So, it's going to be good. It's going to be fun.
What sort of comedy is Stella Young going to offer to us?
Well, it's traditional kind of stand-up comedy, which is sort of ironic because I use a wheelchair and sit down all the time. I've been performing in other people's shows for the last probably 4 or 5 years that I've been doing stand-up, and I decided it was probably finally time to do my own show. So it's called Tales from the Crip, and you're wincing, John.
We don't call people cripples and retards and spastics anymore. You're not allowed to use those sorts of words.
Well, see, I think it depends who you talk to. Like, for me,
you're going to be politically incorrect all the way through your show.
I probably am a little bit, and it's interesting the way, you know, minority communities can kind of reclaim language like that.
So it's like WOG's out of work, you know, making WOG an acceptable term, which I might say I'm still not comfortable with any more than you using the word crip.
Yeah, well, I mean, for me, crip is a really empowering word. I like it. I like cripple as well, but I think that crip is really biting and sarcastic, and it's got a strong activist history.
Has it?
It has, yeah. So if you look at the disability rights movement, particularly in America, Laura Hershey wrote this fantastic piece a few years ago called How Dare I Call Us Crip, about the history of the word, and it's really, really interesting kind of stuff. So, crip is a word that I feel really empowered by, and it allows us to kind of claim space and identify a culture, I guess, in lots of ways.
So do you make fun of yourself or other people, or what sort of comedy are we going to get?
My humour's pretty kind of self-deprecating, but you know, most of the humour in my life comes from the stupid things that normal people say and do,
like,
in response to my disability.
Like?
Oh, like popping out in front of me and saying, "What's wrong with you?" Or just people generally kind of freaking out, not knowing what to say, not knowing what to call you.
Called you Stella. That's pretty straightforward, isn't it?
Well, yes, but people have some weird reactions, John, because I'm kind of small and funny looking, and people don't know how to behave. Disability is still pretty largely invisible in Australia, I think, and we think we know about it. We think we know because we've watched, you know, someone who climbed Everest on Australian Story, or a footballer who's become a quadriplegic tell his sad story. We think that disability is really simple, but in fact, it's not. It's reduced in the media to these, you know, triumph over adversity stories. And that's all. None of it's really the truth. Disability is kind of much more complex than that. We've been sold this great lie that it's very simple.
Well, I'm looking forward to how long's the show?
The show will go for an hour.
An hour of stand-up.
Yes.
That's a lot of material, Stella.
Oh, I've got a lot of material. People say some pretty stupid things to me, John.
So is it sort of storytelling, stream of conscience sort of thing?
Well, yeah. I mean, I'm I'm not gonna perform it in a stream of consciousness kind of way. That'd be terrifying. I'll have an actual script. But yeah, I mean, my comedy's kind of a little bit sort of political, and it's something that I do sort of with social change in mind. I want to change the way people think about what disability means
through comedy from a wheelchair.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So I think, you know, in some ways my whole life is quite performative because I'm always on show. People are always looking at me. And I decided a few years ago that if people were going to stare at me all the damn time, some of that time I was going to be on a stage where they'd have to also listen to what I say. So I like it. I like performing. I think it changes the power dynamic.
Trying to remember, was his name Steady Eddie?
Oh, yeah.
Steady Eddie?
I do. Yeah, I remember him.
Now, I think he had some disability. Was it cerebral palsy or something?
Yeah.
And he was a comedian who kind of did the okay, here's what's wrong with me kind of shtick.
Yeah, I think mine is actually slightly different. Like Steady Eddie did a lot of comedy about how he wasn't, how he was just like everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, for me, it's like, no, I'm actually not just like everybody else. Like I fell in a pile of carrots at the supermarket not very long ago. I lost my footing, fell in a pile of carrots and had to be kind of, had to sit in these damn carrots for a good 5 minutes before someone, well, what felt like about 5 hours, until I could kind of wriggle out of them with someone else's assistance. And it was just these situations in my life, they're directly related to my impairment, and it's hilarious.
How do you think the carrots felt?
I don't know. I don't know. They were poor little baby carrots as well. Very cute.
Mm-hmm.
All the humour in my life comes from either silly things that happen to me because I'm disabled, or silly things that people say in reaction to my disability. So, whereas Steady Eddie, I think, had a slightly different focus, but, yeah, there can be more than one disabled comedian around.
Well, I'm not even sure he's around anymore is the point.
Well, yeah, I haven't come across him on the stand-up circuit at all, and I've been doing this for a couple of years now. So, I don't know. It's just me and Adam Hills.
good point. How thick is your skin? Because it's a pretty cruel world.
Yeah, it's pretty thick, my skin. It's I actually never get heckled. I've talked to other disabled comedians about this. I did a great show in London last year, or the year before, actually, at the Soho Theatre with a comedy troupe called Abnormally Funny People, and they're all disabled comedians. And we talked about the fact that we never get heckled. No one ever heckles us.
No one dares.
No. I think it's too mean.
Oh, now you've opened up the floodgate.
I've now set the challenge. Yeah.
Are you ready for it if it happens?
Yeah. I mean, I think I'm as ready as any comic ever is. Like there's some standard kind of lines that you can sort of pull out to challenge these things.
You got a favourite you want to use now?
Not that I can use on the radio. It 11:15 in the morning, John.
My favourite is something to do with people being told to save their breath. Do you know about that one?
No.
On the basis that the heckler is usually a younger, inebriated male.
Yes, generally speaking.
Generally speaking, the put down is, save your breath, mate. You'll need it for your blow-up girlfriend later tonight.
Nice. I once heard Deanne Smith, who's a Canadian comedian, she once said, actually, it's time that we had a chat because you think you're here for a stand-up show. We're actually not. This is an intervention and we're here to talk about your drinking, which is really great. It really shut this guy up. It was brilliant. So, yeah, you learn these things from seeing other comics and, you know, I know some very, very clever people.
Yeah, so. And I guess your response is, okay, so you think you're clever heckling a disabled comedian and, you know, breaking down the boundaries, that's really brave.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I find the kind heckling harder to deal with.
Mm.
Like, you know, you go, girl, you tell them kind of kind, patronising, condescending heckling is almost worse because there's nowhere to go with that. You can't, you know.
Except say that's patronising, condescending. Thank you very much. Now I feel truly a comic
because
you've heckled me.
I've got the microphone.
Yeah.
That's all you can really do.
Well, I guess if people are truly going to show that they're not discriminating, then they'd heckle you as much as they'd heckle anybody else.
Yes, absolutely.
Bring
I'll
it on.
Look forward to that challenge. Don't be too mean, audience, if you come and see my show.
Well, the other thing is the reviews, of course, which can be much worse than any heckler.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think, you know, I've kind of had this fear as a disabled comedian that people will laugh because they don't dare not to.
Yeah.
Like where I think that that happens in, you know, in our writing, in whatever we do, we kind of fear that we might get a little pat on the back just for showing up and doing something.
She's the very she's the funniest disabled 2.5 foot tall in a wheelchair.
Yeah.
Red-headed comedian I've seen this year.
Yeah. Or, you know, just that thing of we expect very little of disabled people in society, in general in Australia.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think that we get patted on the head metaphorically and sometimes literally for just showing up and not doing very much at all, that it's really hard to assess the quality of our work and to know whether we're being critiqued as harshly as anybody else would, and I think that's a little fear that I've always had, and I've spoken to other disabled comedians about the same thing, and you know they say that's a factor for them as well, and I guess the ideal is to get to a point in your career where you are critiqued just as harshly as anybody else.
Absolutely, and the next issue, of course, is also one of access because comedy festivals are not necessarily that disability access friendly either. So, and particularly if the audience can get in, what about the stage? Because they're not usually designed for people in wheelchairs either.
No, absolutely not. So, this has been a major barrier for me in kind of pursuing stand up because there are just very few rooms that I can perform in. In Melbourne. And, you know, a lot of comics would do, you know, 5 or 6 gigs a week. And I can't do anywhere near that because there is a limited...
And you can't pull a microphone off the stand and walk around the stage with it either.
No, but that's okay. I think I find that quite distracting in some comics. I think sometimes it's good to be still. I could drive around the stage.
You could.
I feel like that would be much more distracting.
Well, that's the audience's problem, not yours.
Yeah. But no, my venue's very accessible. It's going to be good. I've got 2 Auslan interpreted dates as well. So
watch out for Stella Young doing sit down stand up comedy as part of the Melbourne International Comedy Festival. And Reg Livermore will be our first guest on the Conversation Hour, joining us here in the studio in just a moment.
On 774 ABC Melbourne.
And our first guest on the Conversation Hour today is Reg Livermore, who has suddenly been announced as the wizard in the musical of Wicked coming to the Regent Theatre later this year. Congratulations to you, Reg Livermore.
Many thanks, John. Thank you.
And it says here, and I don't believe it, it says you've been on treading the boards for 60 years.
Yep.
Couldn't possibly be true.
Well, not professionally, but certainly, you know, as a young kid, I was having backyard concerts, and at the age of 13, I was hiring local halls to put on my pantomimes in aid of worthy charities like Legacy and the Spastic Centre. And it was all part of my plan, I suppose, my master plan to eventually be a star in the real theatre.
So you just always wanted to be really famous.
I did. Well, I used to read the Woman's Weekly and I'd see, you know, they'd always cover a musical that was in town. I remember when Evie Hayes was in Annie Get Your Gun and I did go and see that as a 10-year-old at the Theatre Royal in Sydney. But this article revealed certain things about, you know, the sort of money you might expect to earn if you became a star. Mm-hmm. And I think I asked my father once, you know, what do you think she might get? He said, well, I don't know, she might get £100 a week. I said, oh, I think that'd be enough. That was back then.
£100?
Yeah, £100.
People would have been earning a couple of pounds a week.
Yes, if that. Yeah. So,
Don't you love the way we've so quickly got down to the crass commercial money side of the business?
I know. Well, you have to. That's the bottom line now. In the olden days, we did things because we really enjoyed them.
Yeah.
And I suppose I was naive, or else I wasn't on the executive side of any production, so I didn't realise that money was important in the end. But I think these days it's moving to a much more cut and dried situation, more ruthless, that if it's not making its money and you lose for 2 weeks, you may as well pack up and go home.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's they're big bets to put on these sorts of shows. But
you're making me nervous about my festival show.
No, calm down.
I'm sure you've got deep pockets and big backers behind.
Yeah, well, I do. Unlike most comedians, I also have a full-time job, so... Yeah. That helps.
You're way ahead.
A day job.
I won't starve.
Yeah. Day job.
And Regis, I'm tiny, so I don't eat that much.
No, you're cheap to maintain.
Yeah. Totally.
And Reg, I suspect you might well have thought that you wouldn't be back on another big musical.
I certainly did. I haven't done anything for 2.5 years. The last thing I did was a show called Turns, which I wrote for Nancy Hayes and myself, and we did an Australia-wide regional tour, 34 different dates, and it was very poorly attended, I have to say, mostly because there was no ongoing publicity in terms of you'd arrive in a town, there was no poster around, nobody knew we were there.
Nothing.
And so it was very demoralising, but I sort of thought it was my fault, but really I think it was the economy, but I chose to blame myself, so I went away to lick my wounds and... 2.5 years later, I'm still licking.
Well, but suddenly someone's had this brilliant idea of saying, oh, we want someone to play the Wicked in the Wizard in Wicked. Mm. And there's Reg Livermore.
There he is.
Does it take much to crank up the skills again?
Well, this is not a huge role.
What's the Wizard do?
Oh, well, he is pivotal to the situation. Mm-hmm. He's a fellow who blew into Oz in a balloon, like they do in Melbourne every morning. And he lands in Oz, and the people are very dejected because they have nothing and no one to believe in. And they decide that this is a messiah for them, and they call him the Wonderful Wicked of Oz, and he quite likes the idea because he's come from a nothing career. You know, he's a snake oil salesman or something like that. And it's important for him to find somebody who will help shore up his position.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it comes into politics in the end. So he's looking for somebody who's the right sort of sorceress to provide the extra powers that he needs to control the population. And so that's why he's after one of the girls who are good at sorcery, Glinda, who becomes the good witch eventually, and Elphaba, who becomes the Wicked Witch of the West. But Elphaba, of course, is the one with the real power. So he has to really woo her because she's very suspicious of him. Mm. She doesn't really like what he's been doing. She's a bit of an animal activist on the side.
Oh, those people.
Yeah.
So how many songs do you have to do?
Oh, two small songs.
That's all?
That's all, yeah.
Oh, it's a bludge.
Well, if you like, it's a cameo. Cameo bludge.
And Reg, you're playing the goody, playing the wizard, but yeah.
He's not necessarily a goody, but he's all right.
Yeah, he's all right.
He's flawed.
Flawed. Yes. It's good. Complex characters are good.
Mm.
But in 1965, you played the Wicked Witch of the West.
I did.
In The Wizard of Oz.
In the pantomime version of The Wizard of Oz at the Tivoli Theatre in Sydney. It was one of the best jobs of my life, I have to say. Because it was more a pantomime than, you know, the versions of The Wizard of Oz they do these days. It's much more like the film. But the version, I was nothing like that. So I really was a panto dame, just tormenting the kids in the auditorium. It was good fun.
Which is almost busking, isn't it, when you're doing that?
Yes, it is, really. You know, you can bring the kids up on stage and leave them there for the Fairy Queen to take care of, go back to the dressing room.
And I'm assuming that there weren't the kind of big stage effects, all the bells and whistles and...
Oh, nothing like the spectacle that Wicked is. No. We did fly, though, you know, on broomsticks. Actually, I think we flew on vacuum cleaners. The old Electroluxes, they were our broomsticks. But that was a good sensation, you know, flying across the stage. It's not something they do lightly these days with all this, you know, the safety acts and, you know, what you can do and what you can't do.
RHS has ruined all the fun.
No. Not really.
Well, they are high-tech, though, all of these shows. They seem to have to have a whiz-bangery to them, don't they? And it's not just the power of the performer anymore. There's got to be some special, you know, I mean, King Kong's winding up, and if it hasn't already wound up, I don't know. But all that sort of stuff's part of it now.
Well, the audiences have been programmed, there's no doubt about it. And I dare say the production houses realise that they have a responsibility to provide all that whiz-banger you talk about.
Yeah.
But the performer is important in the midst of all that. You know, if you're not actually supporting the scenery, you may as well go home.
Mm.
And if the scenery's not supporting you,
yeah,
it may as well go home.
When was Wicked last being done on the stage here?
Well, it's been, it did a about a 3-year Australia tour. It's gone to New Zealand since being in Australia. It's in Manila at the moment.
Okay, so it's coming back.
And it's coming back to the Regent in early May, and we'll play 6 months here, and then we'll go on to Sydney.
Because that's the other aspect of the business at the moment, which is they're reviving a lot of shows that have been in, are they in recess? Is that the phrase? Is that how you describe them?
Well,
they sort of disappear for a while and then come back.
Well, when you're on a good thing, stick to it. And there's no doubt about it. There's a lot of that going on. You know, the fact that they are reviving these shows again, the productions that did so well for them. You know, John Frost, who's a producer of Wicked, he's with the opera company. They're doing The King and I, which he did, you know, some years ago and won a Tony Award for when it played in New York.
Ever done Fiddler on the Roof? That's going to come back one day, I'll bet.
I'll bet it does, yeah.
I mean, all those things are just, they're eternal, aren't they?
No, I've never done it. And I think it's probably too late now.
Is there anything, because you've had such an amazing career and done so many interesting things, is there something that you wish that you had had the opportunity to do that you didn't?
Well, I think because I really started out to be a legitimate actor, you know what I mean, doing plays, and I did quite a few of them with various state theatre companies, the Old Tote, the South Australian Theatre Company, and the Union Theatre down here.
Real theatre?
Real theatre, yes. And so I did always see myself as one of the future Laurence Olivier in those days. And I wanted to play some of the big Shakespearean roles. But my misfortune was that I happened to be born at the same time as John Bell. So one of us had to give way, and it was me. But then I've done things that he couldn't do. So, you know, it's fair's fair. You've got to share it around.
Yeah, he's not the wizard. In Wicked now.
So you could have the Bell Shakespeare Company and the Livermore Vaudeville Company to go with it.
I think he often has a touch of vaudeville in his shows, but he's never asked me.
Damn it.
No, damn it. All.
You should get the two of you going together.
I don't know.
But lots of Shakespeare's got, well, it's got heaps of comedy, occasional farce.
And yes, yeah.
Would lend itself to your approach, I suspect. Just need a bold enough director to be able to trust you to take it where you want to take it.
The language, of course, sometimes gets in the way.
Oh, I'm sure you'd cope if you needed to, Red.
Yes, I would. You're right.
Well, you've done all sorts of things apart from theatre, though. You've hosted, like, is it a gardening show?
I was on Burke's Backyard for a while.
Yes.
And then I went into another show called Our House.
Yes.
Where my sort of forte became the cooking segment, which I used to do from home, and that was very convenient.
just set up in your own kitchen with a camera.
Yeah. That's how it was.
Film cooking your dinner. Awesome.
But I certainly have been involved in gardens, and so, you know, that's why I was invited to join the Burke's Backyard show.
Yeah.
But I found it was quite difficult to know what to say because Mr. Burke, he seemed to know more than anybody else.
Well,
so I was always frightened to open my mouth.
What, because you'd get stuff wrong?
Well, of course you can.
Yeah.
And he was meticulous, you know, about what was, you know, that the right thing was being said.
Yeah.
Not just my sort of impression of what's going on here.
But he's a very shrewd businessman, too.
Oh, yes,
he knew exactly how to press your buttons on his TV show for years and years and years.
Do you think a show like that would work today? Because I just, it kind of amazes me when I look back that, you know, a gardening nerd could make such an amazing career in entertainment when, you know, was just a guy who was really, like, obviously a talented presenter, but basically just really nerdy about gardening. Do you think that would work today?
Well, we have reflections of that. You know, the ABC has its gardening program, and that's gone through various transformations with the sorts of hosts that they've provided. And there's always a...
Controversially.
and the commercial stations usually have a gardening segment.
Yeah.
I think all those sorts of things will always be there. It just depends, you know, they often need a bit of a twist or a tweak to make them
sort
just
of
slightly different.
Replaced by the reality TV competition shows instead now, aren't they?
Yes.
Where they cover similar sorts of issues but in a competitive and soap opera-ish way.
Yeah, they're more the backyard blitz kind of, making over your backyard.
Yeah.
Just a phase.
Yeah.
Another phase.
You've seen it all.
I have seen it all.
Seen it come, seen it go.
Yeah. maybe your next project after Wicked could be combining a gardening show with musical theatre. Like a musical gardening show?
No. Not I.
With stand-up comedy.
Yeah, I can do the stand-up segment if you like.
Yeah.
I can't do anything about gardening, though. I'm terrible at gardening. I once killed a cactus. I'm not to be trusted with plants or living things.
Killed a cactus.
Hmm.
Because?
Well, because I thought that you didn't have to water them ever. Apparently that's not true. Apparently they do require some water. But
so
yeah.
When you say you killed it, how did you actually care for it if you didn't water it?
I sat it on the shelf.
You looked at it.
Yes.
Gardening by looking.
Yeah. That's all you need to do, right, with a cactus. It's low maintenance. I was once given a bonsai tree as a housewarming gift.
They are high maintenance.
They are very high maintenance. My mum has a lovely bonsai garden.
Mm-hmm.
But my bonsai tree didn't last very long. I was given it by a friend as a housewarming present, and she thought it was really funny to give her dwarf friend a dwarf tree.
I was avoiding the bonsai person with a bonsai plant joke. Yeah.
Pretty hilarious. It didn't last very long.
What did you do to that one, Stella?
Oh, it just kind of shriveled up and died. I watered it, but I think I also sat it in the sun and maybe gave it too much. Well, I don't know.
No, you should have put the cactus in the sun and created a virtual desert for it. And the bonsai you could have put out into the garden, and eventually the roots would have gone through the drainage holes and it would be a 15-foot tree by now.
Oh, right.
And then you'd have real problems. Yeah. Reg, congratulations. Reg Livermore is, after an extraordinary career, we can go back to Jesus Christ Superstar and Hair, Betty Blockbuster, Rocky Horror, you name it, he's done it. Including opera and television, Reg Livermore will be the wizard in the Regent Theatre's production of Wicked. Stella, I have a suggested great put-down for you. When somebody's mobile phone rings during a performance.
Yeah?
If that's Shane Warne, tell him I told him not to call me at work.
That's not bad. I might use that.
David
Thanks.
From Castlemaine sent that in. He heard Sandy Jeffs, the mad poet, use that one. And Steady Eddie is apparently live and well living up northern Queensland, north of Gympie or Gladstone somewhere, and still working as a comedian.
Fabulous.
Lots of text messages coming in about everything we've talked about. Our next guest joining us in just a moment here on The Conversation Hour is Kate Dundas. She's a landscape architect, and she thinks we waste too much of our space. We waste land, and after all, land's pretty special. They don't make it anymore. That's coming up next.
On 774 ABC Melbourne.
Kate Dundas is a landscape architect and urban designer. She works for Planisphere. She's the co-founder of an organisation that wants to unlock underutilised land. It's called 3,000 Acres. Kate, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Why do we waste land?
We waste an awful lot of land. I'm sure you're aware when you walk around Melbourne, when you walk around the city, you constantly see development sites that are waiting for building. Sometimes, you know, for 1 year, 10 years, they lie redundant and empty. You know, they could be put to much better use. And it's not just development sites. There's areas beside railways, there's roundabouts, and not to mention rooftops.
Roundabouts?
Well, yeah.
What do you want to do with roundabouts?
Well, there's lots of fun things we can do with roundabouts.
What, in the middle?
Sure.
Like what?
We can plant them.
Yeah, with what?
Vegetables.
But then
Well, no growing stuff, so you can see what's coming.
Well, it needs to be low, of course, because you don't want anybody to be crashing around the roundabouts. But
or admiring the carrots and the zucchini and running over a pedestrian.
What we want is to get things growing in public spaces so people can connect back into nature and back into the landscape.
You'd have to get rid of the possums first.
Oh, I can eat the possums.
Oh! How long have you been here?
I've eaten a few.
But how long have you been here?
Oh, I've only been here for 2 years. I'm from Glasgow.
Ah.
Yeah.
Never could have guessed. Well, possums are protected, Kate.
Well, just eat them in secret.
Now we know what's in haggis.
So you're advocating using this space, even if it's only temporary.
Absolutely.
So that's not an eyesore for 3 years, 10 years. That something can be made of it and it can be useful and good for the soul.
It's good for the soul. It's good for your health. We're facing an obesity epidemic in Australia. 63% of people are overweight or obese, which is not the impression you get when you're in Glasgow watching Neighbours and Home and Away. Everybody looks quite different.
Yes.
But everybody's becoming fat and unhappy. And there's something we can do about it, and that's using our land better. You know, for the first time in history, there's more people living in an urban context than in a rural context. And what's happening is that we're losing our connection with nature. We don't know where our food's coming from. We make really poor choices when it comes to diet. And that leads to us getting fat and getting sad.
You come from cities that have a history going back way, way, way further than we do.
Yes.
When you come then to a society like this one,
yes,
what is it that hits you about our land use, the way we organise stuff?
Well, sprawl, obviously. Everybody lives in detached dwellings, normally with a front and back garden, which I often think about, is that what makes Melbourne the best place to live? You know, it always ranks number one. And yet you have incredible sprawl. And the people, it's a very different world in the inner suburbs than it is in the outer suburbs. People have access to fresh fruit and vegetables, whereas in the outer suburbs they don't. People have to drive really far to get anywhere. It's a completely different lifestyle. If you're at home as a woman with a child in the outer suburbs, you're often completely isolated. Mm. Whereas in the inner suburbs, it's a different world. The sprawl is certainly something that is very obvious. I mean, another one is access to land to grow fruit and vegetables. In the UK, there's allotments everywhere. In Australia, there's hardly any. So when I first arrived and tried to find somewhere to grow and, you know, meet people, I couldn't. And that's what kind of spurred this project, getting people to be able to access land, because there's such a lot of it that's wasted. There's such a lot that's underutilised. And yet getting access to it is so incredibly difficult. There's a lot of barriers in the way.
We don't have any great incentives for people to do anything other than fence their land and say, everybody go away, it's mine.
Well, that's what we're trying to change.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So how do you do that? What are the easiest and primary methods used?
Well, we have this project called 3,000 Acres, which Vic Health put out a question last year to try and improve the supply and access of fresh fruit and vegetables. And our response was to make it easier for more people to grow more food in more places. Because if you grow your own food, you eat more of it more often, you get healthier. And our response was a built environment response. So trying to make it much easier to access these sites. And how we're doing it is multifaceted. So we've got a website, it's called 3000acres.org. And that allows people to find bits of land, map the bits of land on the website, but also to form groups. Because we all know it's much easier to do things together.
A sort of co-op situation.
Yes. Yeah. So form groups and self-organise around bits of land. That's one way. And I should say it's inspired by a project in New York called 596 Acres. And that
we've gone for 3,000.
Well, yeah, because we're better.
Yeah. We've got more room.
We've got more room, exactly. In New York, they actually managed to find 596 acres. And that project's incredible. It's run by lawyers. So, yeah, they're right on to the best way to get equitable access to land, which is what we want to try and do.
596 and a half acres.
And that idea has spread all across America. And now we're bringing it to Australia. So we have our website. The other thing that we're trying to do is form partnerships. So we're partnering with various different councils. We've got inner city councils, but we also want to target growth area and outer suburban councils. And we're also also partnering up with developers. And our first developer, Neo Metro, I should say that in an Australian accent because it's not Neil Mitchell, Neo Metro. gave us a little bit of land in Fitzroy, and we've turned a car park into a community garden. And that garden will be
paved
there.
Paved paradise. Put up a parking
put
lot.
Put up a parking lot. And yeah, then we said, goodbye, parking lot. Welcome, vegetables.
Yeah.
And
that's great.
Yeah, we're offering growing space to local residents who live in apartments and don't have anywhere to grow. We're teaching skills. We've got the botanic gardens and diggers coming to the garden to teach people how to grow. But the ultimate aim is to make it really easy and really normal for people to grow their own fruit and vegetables, to teach children to get access to nature, to get outside, get our hands dirty.
Well, certainly nature strips are changing. And yes, not far from where we live, some people have started cultivating on the nature strip. And they've got little signs up saying, if you want to contribute, that's fine. But if you want to take, you also have to give. So you can do a bit of weeding, or you can come and help with a watering can or whatever. But you're very welcome to join in. And that's been a really good thing. And
yeah,
it's respected.
It is. What we don't want to see is traditional community gardens with fences around. This is a community project, should be open to everybody. It's not an exclusive land use. It's a communal land use.
How do you stop people nicking the pumpkins?
Great. If people are going to nick the pumpkins and eat them, that's absolutely brilliant. Go for it.
Not if I've been nurturing the pumpkin and I planned it for next Sunday and then it's gone when I go to pick it.
You'll just have to grow more than one.
Oh. Yeah. What about gardens that are not providing vegetables? You know, like the squares in London have this sort of designated, they have to have a key to get into them, but, I mean, it's their space. And do you encourage that sort of thing as well? Just a you know, a garden or a little parkland that's useful, good for the soul, but
absolutely.
Maybe not good for the appetite. But.
Yeah, absolutely. I think nature gardens are incredibly important for habitat and connection to nature. We don't want people to have keys and for them to be exclusive.
No.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And I have to say, I love the idea of a musical gardening show. That would be wonderful. We could do it together, Reg. What do you reckon?
Well, you want to be in musicals, don't you?
I do. I was telling Reg earlier, it's my dream to be in musicals.
She wants to be in Grease 2.
I just, you know that bit where Michelle Pfeiffer goes up the ladders? Cool rider, get on the motorbike at the end. That'd be brilliant.
So it's very specifically Grease 2, not Grease 1.
Very specifically Grease 2. Me and my sister were obsessed by it when we were children. So
Excellent.
Well, we'll have to try and organise a workshop for this show.
We could do Grease 2 combined with some kind of vegetable gardening and come up with a whole new musical.
I can think of some pretty greasy vegetables that you could use. There's all sorts of opportunities there. But more seriously, Kate, I mean, what you're doing is you're trying to change the way people think about things,
yes.
But at the same time, you've got to tap into money because nothing happens without money.
We certainly have to tap into money.
Well, where does the money come from?
Well, we were lucky enough to receive $100,000 from Vic Health last year, and that was because we won the Seed Challenge along with the Open Food Network, both of which were improving the supply and access to fruit and vegetables. So our task now, up until that money runs out, is to try and find some more. So I would like to put a call out to any developers who'd like to partner with 3,000 acres. We need land, we need resources, we need money. We'll be workshopping with our business advisors, who are all pro bono assistants, to try and come up with a plan, because this will not happen without money.
Well, I've never seen an ad for instance, I don't study these things anyway, but I haven't seen an ad for apartments in a new development saying, and we boast along with the gym, the theatre and the swimming pool, we've got a veggie garden.
Yeah, great.
Never seen that.
Well, it happens in the UK and it's incredibly successful.
And that attracts people?
It attracts people because people are attracted to that community spirit and access to land. Yeah.
I did once have lunch with a property developer who said they wanted to tell me about what was going on in their industry, and we ended up agreeing that a really interesting thing would be to advertise a men's shed in some of the apartments they were offering, because they were targeting the retirement sector. When people downsize and often go to an apartment. And they were saying, you know, the things that what people are worried about, security and safety and, you know, the sort of facilities we've just mentioned, but a men's shed, they'd never thought of saying, well, a lot of blokes don't want to move to an apartment because they still want to have access to a shed.
I just think the men's shed movement is fantastic.
Yeah.
They don't have it in the UK, and that was something we kind of advocated for in projects back there. It's just brilliant. And there's the synergy that could be offered between men's sheds, allotments within the city and within new developments. I mean, imagine in a development site, if the first thing that went in was a garden and a men's shed, then you can start creating community immediately.
And a musical in a men's shed about gardening.
Every fortnight on a Sunday.
Why not?
It's just so good, you know, being outside and you know, growing things. And even though I'm a completely useless gardener, I love spending time in lovely gardens. And it's something that I miss because I live in a little apartment now with just a little balcony.
Mm-hmm.
And I grew up in the country, so I, you know, spend less time, you know, as one with nature than I used to, and it's something that I miss and have to kind of go and seek out. Mm-hmm. And there are such fantastic parks and gardens in Melbourne.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it'd be great if they, you know, started building gardens in car parks. And
it's a
fantastic project.
It's so easy if it wasn't for the planning system. So our first garden, it took 4 months to get a planning permit, because community gardens aren't recognised within the planning system. That's something we want to change.
Mm.
We had to pay for a planning permit, $800 in 4 months, to put 12 buckets in a car park. That's not acceptable.
No. It shouldn't be that hard.
It shouldn't be that hard. And, you know, there's such fantastic examples. In Vancouver, they've got a project called Soul Food Farms, and that transforms giant big areas of what would be redundant old ex-industrial land into productive market gardens. Mm. And they're economically viable. They make money. They train people who need to get back into work. And they transition land uses, which would otherwise just lie empty, collecting rubbish and looking really sad.
Mm. And we were talking about the A-Line in New York, the raised railway that's now abandoned, disused, and they've turned that
High Line, is it?
Yep. High Line. Mm-hmm. Into gardens. And so the people who live in the area are using that as, you know, as their recreation.
Oh, it's a huge tourist attraction.
And as Kate said, a different view from that high up in the air. And the fact that, you know, tearing it down would just create such an upheaval.
So, Kate, what's the action plan?
The action plan is to get the community mapping land. This is a project to facilitate community action. We're there to offer a helping hand. We can help people get through the planning barriers, the legal barriers, the insurance barriers, and help people access land. But ultimately, it's down to the community to self-organise, to get involved, get their hands dirty. And we want to speak to developers and councils. This is it has to be a collaborative project. I mean, one other thing to pick up on the High Line, that project was
in New York.
Yep. That project was driven, it was a grassroots community-driven project. And the people responsible for that really drove it until it was successful. But what happened there was grassroots action, policy change and leadership from the top. And that's what we need. Nothing happens from one end or the other. We need both. We need policy, we need government leadership, but we also need grassroots action. All of it.
Okay, I'm trying to think. Space between freeways, for instance, the median strip down the middle of the freeway. There's Eastern Freeway.
Yeah.
Huge, great tracts of land, but it's completely dangerous to get there.
Yeah.
What do you do there? Anything?
Well, there's a project called Farming the Hydro Fields, which is all about farming underneath power lines. And I think they worked out that they could feed an entire city from that. So we shouldn't rule it out because it's potentially difficult to get to. I mean, there could be a ways of overcoming that.
There's no water.
Yeah, there's no water.
There's no access without getting across the freeway.
Mm, yeah.
And so, in time, it'll probably be used to widen the freeway anyway.
To make it wider
another lane.
Wider and wider.
Maybe not because the most important.
Until they make the middle, there's just that tiny little chink of light between.
Because we all know, Reg, that bigger and bigger freeways are the way to... someone did have an idea, didn't they? Oh, that's right. It was going to solve all the traffic problems.
Oh, yes.
That's right.
That works. We've seen that work historically.
Yeah, look at LA. Brilliant.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah. I mean, what are we supposed to do, though, with, you know, water restrictions and things like that?
Very good point.
Water the gardens.
That's a very, very good point and something that we're researching at the moment with Melbourne Water. We want to have best practice sustainable water use gardens. And another thing to look at is indigenous bush food that doesn't actually require so much water. Mm-hmm. So definitely something that needs research and something that we're looking at just now.
We could farm kangaroos in the median strip. After all, they go well with cars on freeways, don't they?
They were meant for each other.
Yeah. Full of good ideas. In fact, a musical involving kangaroos, men's sheds, veggie gardens.
And possums.
Oh, and possum eating.
Oh, God, I can't believe I said that.
Eating possums.
It's all right for socks.
You here on a temporary or a permanent visa?
Not sure now,
are
you?
Let's not bring that up. Yeah, it's hopefully permanent.
The transcript of this is being referred off to the immigration department as we speak.
I'll have a restraining order. Not allowed in parks at night time. Stay away from the possums.
Text messages galore, including whatever happened to Victoria, the Garden State.
Bring it back. Help us.
Yeah, absolutely right. And Reg, it will be wonderful to have you back in town.
Yes, thank you.
Might get you to come in and play from time to time while you're here. Yeah. And Stella Young from the ABC's disability website, Ramp Up. Stella, Reg, Kate, it's been great fun. Watch out for the possums and thank you all for coming.
Thank you.
774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria, this has been your Conversation Hour.
The Conversation Hour podcasts are available at abc.net.au/Melbourne. Subscribe now and you'll receive automatic updates with special guests, interesting interviews. It's a bit of fun. You'll be mad not to subscribe. abc.net.au/Melbourne.